It's time to talk about the outdoors in South Alabama. Hunting, fishing, and getting outside along the Great Gulf Coast. It's time to take it outside with FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. With reports, stories, how-to information, and Dr. Bill's Marine Forecast. Here's Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
Right, welcome FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors, and we are live at the grounds for the G&D Farms Outdoor Expo. Day number two. Doors are open. Hopefully get you out here soon today. Open till 8 tonight. You can do this till tonight and tomorrow from 10 to 4. Now, we talked about it yesterday on Midday Mobile when I was out here, that today would be a great day to come because you got the archery going on for the Mobile County teams, and the kids are in here shooting already, and you can see them do that. But in addition, today is seminar day. And when Lee Davis, who you probably hear in the background right now, Lee Davis with G&D Farms, who puts this event on, told me, hey, Sean, this is some time ago, we're lining up our guests that are going to be here at the G&D Farms Outdoor Expo, and he mentioned this man's name. I said, holy cow, you've hit a home run. Big fan of this guy, and amazing to have him on the show today. And we're going to get some pick his brain on a couple subjects, and then you're going to go deeper when you come to the seminar this afternoon. I'll say quietly, Hail State. Dr. Bronson Strickland, you know him from Mississippi State University, Deer Lab. You know him from podcasts. You know him from videos. You know him from a man doing out front science on deer research out there. Thanks for hopping on with me.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
This is a real treat, as this event time-wise is, I mean, there's some of us, I'm looking at somebody who dedicated his life to it, are interested in this year-round, but there's obviously this time of year people really focused on deer and thinking about what's happening where they hunt.
That's exactly right. Well, hunting season is upon us, and hopefully those that have been managing, mm-hmm. now that we're going to get the fruits of all of their labor and time, and so, yeah, it's the time of year to be excited.
You know, I think when I hear you talk on other shows and podcasts, when you say management, I think this is interesting because you've broken it down to bite-sized pieces of people, whether they're on a lease, maybe they or they have the family 40 or 120 or 160. You give plans for those folks versus, like, you spent time out in Texas, part of your education stuff. Yeah, there's things you can do when you have a 10,000-acre ranch in Texas that, you know, are a little different than the person says, I got a 160, I got my grandfather's 80. You have ideas for those people for management as well.
Yeah, there's a range of things that you can do depending on what you can do. So
right.
Obviously, if you lease land, you have limitations yeah. on managing habitat, timber, et cetera, versus if you own land, then it basically opens up the entire toolbox
sure.
of the things you can do.
And that's, you know, and I'm so lucky to own land, but I've hunted my whole life, either on most of my life on public or lease land. And yeah, there's a frustration, but you do have ideas that even on lease land, timber company land, there are some things you can do to improve what's going on with your deer. Now, that's one of the things you've done. I want to talk about habitat management with you, and also what these bucks are doing and when, and we'll get to that in a second. Like, every time I look at one of your collar studies, I'm like, well, we all thought all the bucks did this, and we find out from your research, some bucks do this.
Some
bucks do something else.
That's right.
Some bucks do a third thing. Habitat management-wise, what do you think is the lowest hole in the bucket, weakest link that's going on in the Southeast with deer management?
Yeah, probably the biggest thing, and there's a lot of ways to dissect that, but open ground. Meaning we don't have enough acreage on a property where sunlight is growing deer food. And that could be because it's closed canopy forest. It might be that it's pasture, so the sunlight is being tied up in food for cows.
Yep.
But when you just think about how much open ground do you have that is producing those broadleaf plants, and us nerds, we call them forbs.
Yeah, yeah.
But those broadleaf plants, that is the foundation of a deer's diet, and that is the single most limiting factor that we see.
Okay. With that, some watching videos over time with you and your contemporaries on this, and I'm big. We have longleaf forest, and I burn. I'm a pretty tight burn rotations on this. I watched some research here on the pounds of available forage. And of course, it depends on when you burn and all that, how much grass is, how much forbs. But it was shocking to me that, and nothing against food plots, and we're here, you know, I do food plots as well, but the tonnage produced by by burns and coming back from it's something. It's like people burn this. Oh, it looks good. Aesthetically, it's fine. It's going to be maybe, you know, good for my turkeys down the road. But for deer food, it's amazing.
Yeah, we typically see a minimum of a 5-fold increase, and it might be a 10-fold increase or more. So when you look at what you can produce per acre, so you got 1 acre, the best thing you can do is a food plot. You're going to maximize forage production. But when you look at what you can apply over the greatest amount of acres on your property, it's going to be habitat management.
Yep.
So you might be getting 1,000 to 1,500 pounds per acre with managed habitat versus 3,000 or 4,000 pounds per acre with a food plot.
Yeah, well, so I tell you what,
do
price,
both.
Yeah, well, yeah, you do both. And price-wise, you know, me with a drip torch and a burn permit, you know, even though I do food plots, but it's a lot less expensive
to let
nature do what it's going to do.
And you're providing a diversity of forages. You know, when you think about it, a deer, they've been living here for a long, long time.
Right. Well, before we managed them.
They eat a whole bunch of different plants,
right.
And they all have different chemical signatures, little things they need. Just like if you and I go to the buffet, number one, you and I aren't going to get the same thing.
Correct.
Or individuals. And you're going to get a bunch of different foods, most likely.
Yeah,
you're not
right
just going to eat the ribs. You're going to get a bunch of other stuff. Same thing for a deer. So habitat management complements all that work you're putting into food plots with diversity.
You know, I think about in that diversity, too, just gleaning for the research y'all have done and your contemporaries, so much is focused on protein. Preseason, right? Like, we're trying to they got to have protein. We've got to build antlers. Going to, you know, protein. And people think soybeans and all these things that you can come in and plant. But you look at the crude protein in some of the plants that have been here, you know, whether we're talking about, like, ragweed number. Like, ragweed, what is it?
A minimum of 18, sometimes over 20, depending on its stage of growth.
And so, beans are what soybeans are?
Yeah, it could be 20 to 25.
So something that, I mean, is in the neighborhood of that.
Absolutely.
That's going to come back. Partridge peas.
Yes.
You know, things like that.
Pokeweed.
These things.
Beggar's lice, desmodium.
Yes.
All that stuff is out there, and it's all very high quality.
And this is, I mean, so you could say if you're doing that kind of management and setting back succession, you are on a protein program. And people say, well, I'm doing protein. Like, yeah, well, so am I.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right.
So,
and I would add, there's also a lot more nutrients that can be just as limiting or more
so
than
protein. Give us some of those.
We just always think of protein. It's very easy to measure.
Because it's 1 + 1, we think, which I know you're the doctor
right.
here. I'm just the hunter. But 1 + 1 equals bigger racks.
Right.
Protein equals antler.
Yeah. You know what also is important for antlers is phosphorus. And so when you start measuring all of these plants on the landscape, you'll often see, it'll depend on where you're at, but you'll often see that phosphorus can be more limiting than the protein.
Okay, so where are we getting that? Because, I mean, I think about, you know, when we're getting a fertilizer, we're looking at the phosphorus number, but in native grasses or forbs, where's phosphorus?
It's in those plants.
Even the same ones,
Absolutely. It is already in those plants. And so you think about, not to say that you can't add it, but think about deer, again, going back to, they've been here for thousands of years. And when you do a chemical analysis of all of these native plants, you get a readout of what was the protein, what was the phosphorus, what was the potassium, what was the calcium. We don't think of a mineral being in a plant.
Right. We think it's in the dirt, but the plants are in the dirt.
They are absorbed and they're in the plant tissue, and that is how those deer get those minerals.
So with this program, do you see more of this happening, more of that kind of getting some sunlight equaling all these great things? Are more people, I mean, you do this every day, are more people going to having more open ground? Because it used to be, it's a dual-edged sword. It's bad when you grow timber that the prices are, I don't want to use that word on there, not great. But at the same time, maybe everybody's not as committed to making every acre of their property in row planted loblolly.
Yeah. Yeah, so landowners have really got to make some decisions now. You know, timber was a very viable option with the former timber markets, and it may come back. But now we just really have to think about, if you're a property owner or lease land or whatever, but specifically you've bought a recreational property, you got to start from the beginning and say, what do I want a decade or 2 decades from now? Is the reason I bought this property to make some timber income a decade from now, or is it the recreational value of seeing deer, hunting big deer, et cetera, seeing and hunting turkeys And you've got to kind of recalibrate your thinking, because that easy, low-hanging fruit of just grow some timber, cut it, make some money, for most people, that option's off the table now.
Right. So that, maybe that helps folks like you guide people more in their management decisions, since that the payday is really not like it used to be. All right, coming right back, Dr. Bronson Strickland, our guest. He's going to be speaking today right here at the G&D Farms Outdoor Expo. We'll talk more about that when we come back. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors, live from the G&D Farms Outdoor Expo. Day number two. Love to see you out here. We are at the grounds of the Hocklander Building. And one of the folks you'll hear out here today is my guest right now. And I'm so, so happy to have him on the show. And maybe I can get him, right now on the air, put him on the spot. You'll come back on the show in the future?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Anytime.
Good. Dr. Bronson Strickland, MSU Deer Lab, and a man that is a font of information when it comes to deer. I want to talk about this. Number one, and we'll repeat this, but you are speaking today at what time?
1 o'clock.
1 o'clock. So 1 o'clock here, you can hear Dr. Strickland's presentation, and then tomorrow?
At 1 o'clock.
1 o'clock. So there you go. You only have to remember one number, y'all. It's 1 o'clock both days to hear Dr. Strickland. All right. So we talked about habitat management, but I want to talk about deer research as well. And some of the things you put up, and people need to follow you on social media in the Deer Lab, you confirmed some things I thought, and you blew me away on some things out there. You know, just, I mean, we get these ideas that all the deer do this or all the deer do that. And what was neat about your research is, yeah, a lot of deer do this, or a lot of bucks do this, and some other bucks do this. And then a third group, you know, cohorted bucks do this other thing.
Right.
Right. What got you into, like, when you decide what you're going to research, you're gonna have a plan, and how do you pick the thing? Is it crowdsourced? Is it you going, here's what I'm interested in? How do you figure those things out?
Yeah, well, it's generally derived from hunters and managers. So when you think about someone like us at a university, we're going to get a lot of our funding from our state wildlife agency.
Right.
So for me, Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks, and there's only so many questions they can tackle.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are fielding information from hunters and managers throughout the state, and they wanted, like with our buck movement study, where do they go? We don't understand. We're putting into all this work. We're managing these deer. We're getting them on camera. We see bachelor groups during the summer, and then poof, they're gone.
Uh-huh.
What's going on?
Yeah.
I
joined their question.
Yeah.
It is this combination of things, and I'm sure it has, and it has probably a solid biological reason to move genetics around.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's, you know, I think about the hunt out west, and I think about these big migrations and movements for mule deer, this and that. We kind of always thought, oh, this buck range, their home bodies, but whitetail bucks, some of them just go on walkabout.
About 30%, and you can break that apart two ways. All of them will go on a walkabout that we call an excursion.
Okay.
And so every single buck will do that, and the number is 2.6 times a year. But two to three times a year, they're going to do what we'd call a weekend trip. They're going to do about a two-day loop outside of their home range.
And of course, you know my next question, follow on. When is there any pattern to when they take these two to three excursions?
The least amount of excursions are during the summer.
Okay.
But we have them in fall. It will spike in winter. So we really start to see it during
the
rut.
Okay.
And then in the post-rut, that's the greatest amount of them. And that will trickle into the spring, and it goes to its lowest level during the summer.
So there is this pattern. Now, and that's an excursion. And the excursion, how do you define the distance for an excursion? Does it have a parameter what excursion is, miles-wise?
Well, we define it's an excursion because they come back.
Okay.
Versus what we call a shift, a home range shift that we just call mobile bucks. So they're spending part of their year in one place, and they spend part of their year distinctly different with no overlap whatsoever in another area. And that is 30% of the bucks are doing that.
They're just, so this, and I mean, I've gone through, I think everybody manages and who runs cameras knows this. There's that bachelor group of bucks, a couple of them fantastic. You're looking at them August, you know, Belvedere, and then they are gone.
And then they're gone.
You may see them in somebody's picture from 2 miles away that killed
that's
that
right.
deer.
Or 4 or 5 miles away,
yeah.
And you assume that he's gone or he's dead, and
yeah.
sure enough, you see it on Facebook,
yeah.
and somebody like,
yeah,
killed
I
7 miles
that,
away.
So, and is there any predictive to age class or anything, the buck that will do the split versus the excursion?
There may be. We have not uncovered that. There is no age.
It's not a young buck thing. It's not a 3-year-old. It's not a 5-year-old thing.
For example, our single best example was the buck that crossed the Mississippi River.
Yes. Y'all got to watch this research. Talk about that real quick.
Yeah. So he was captured, collared in Mississippi during fall, winter.
Okay.
And then come about February, March, he went all the way to the Mississippi River, staged, walked up and down the river a few days, swam the river, spent his summer. And he was very affluent. He had a summer home and a winter home.
He did it as a verb, but like the fancy people say, they summer. Summer. What was he in Louisiana? He got to
Louisiana.
Yeah,
and so you
like
look at where he spent the summer and you say, oh, well, it was an agricultural area. So he went for soybeans.
But there's ag right there in the Mississippi Delta.
Right where he was collared was also just as much agriculture. So food was not the explanation. And then there's other bucks all around him.
And it's not like he just went distance. Y'all have driven across the Mississippi River. Not that, you know, Tom Bigby and Alabama are big, but they are not Mississippi River big.
Right. And so
he risked his life. I mean, risked the genetics. Yes. If you think about the job of the animal to carry on genetics, something must have been so strong that the body would risk losing the genetics by drowning to go that far.
Right. It's just his instinct. This is what he has to do. It is in him. And most amazingly, and he may have done it for more years. We only had a collar on him for two. So number one, he did it 2 years in a row. So it was a pattern. And he departed and came back within a week of doing that. So it's not even that he had the instinct to do it. It's the timing.
Do you think it's a length of day thing?
Clock.
Like looking for waterfowl migration and all that? Like length of day? Like,
well, I think it's a photo period.
Yeah, photo period triggers
so much with deer and wildlife. I think that was it.
You know, and I think about it, it makes sense. We always talk about calendar birds and duck hunting. Like, you know, the birds are going to come no matter what, even if we don't have a cold front. They're coming versus the ones that you got to have a cold front. But the deer photo period is still.
Oh, that drives everything. Absolutely. Yeah.
So I do something controversial here before we wrap up. Photo period, full moon, what effects? Like, this is the oldest argument ever. Like, does it have
effects? Makes you feel good.
I don't
do it.
Stop with that, Dr. No. What does science say? What is
science? We find no evidence that any phase of the moon or even the position of the moon is affecting buck movement behavior whatsoever.
So all this stuff that we said, well, I'm going to take vacation, y'all. Did you look at the moon table? It's going to be good.
Yeah, it doesn't show up. No, take your vacation. Take your vacation based on the rut, not the moon.
Okay. Because, you know, like, it took up, I don't know how many pages of magazines growing up that, you know, here's your moon charts for the next month.
Yeah, we looked at all of it, could not find any evidence.
So we've learned new things, and we're constantly learning new things. It still is exciting out there. I think, you know, I wonder about that. I have a friend of mine that says all the cameras and all the stuff we do and all the stuff we learn, he thinks takes some of the mystique. I love it, but he said it takes some of the mystique out of just going, getting a ladder stand, hunting a deer. Do you ever hear people say that?
Oh, like, constantly. And it probably does. And now we got to add drones to it.
Yeah.
You know, so we got to be careful with that. It does, but my goodness, I would say it also helps for those that are enthusiastic and want to learn more about their deer herd. It adds so much to that. So it's like a lot of things. It can be abused, but if done correctly, I think it will enrich someone as a hunter and manager.
I'm the flip side of him. I consume everything that comes out, every bit of research that comes out, then run my own, you know, camera sets and all that. But I think it makes me more excited about it. It makes me say that. And also on the habitat management side, that what you have today is not the status quo forever on that property.
That's right.
People say, well, if you want to kill big deer, and there are some areas, obviously, that are better, but that you have to leave where you hunt to go to some far-flung location to kill bigger deer, where we're learning you give it time.
Give it time.
You can do it right there where you live.
You can do it here. You got to keep your expectations reasonable.
Right.
You're not going to do in South Alabama what you do in Saskatchewan.
Right.
But around here,
everybody will tell us this is not going to happen. All right, people want to get your social media. I want them to come out here today. I know you'll talk about it at 1 o'clock and 1 o'clock tomorrow. But where do they reach out? Where do they get more information? This stuff we've been talking about.
Yeah, go to MSU Deer Lab. That can be on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. And then also the podcast, Deer University, is where you're going to hear us talking about this kind of information.
And y'all, when you listen to Deer University, too, you're going to find, seriously, like I started off the conversation with Dr. Strickland, it's not going to be just, here's a management plan when you own 10,000 acres. Y'all have things for, you're on a hunting club. You have a 40 that's your family land, something like that. There's things you can be doing today. Don't just say, I don't have the 5,000-acre track and I can't do anything, because you sure can.
That's right. And even topics like, it doesn't matter if you lease land or own land. What's wrong with my deer at the skin and shed? You know, things that you commonly encounter. Should I eat the meat? We try to address everything that would be important to a manager or a hunter. We have.
I didn't say the
covered.
Letters Charlie Wilco Delta at all.
I didn't hear you say that.
So right now I still feel good, but we're this pocket here, you know, where we have not had any positives. Mm-hmm. I know North Alabama's gotten some, and hopefully if those prions don't travel at 70 miles an hour in the back of a truck, we don't have them here anytime soon.
I hope that's the case.
Dr. Strickland, thank you.
Thank you so much.
1 o'clock today.
1 o'clock today.
1 o'clock tomorrow. And then I'm going to just put you on the spot. We'll trade numbers. You'll come on the show in a week to come.
Sure. Happy to.
Like he has nothing else to do. Thank you. All right, coming right back. More of FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors live from the G&D Outdoor Expo. Welcome back, FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors, and we are live at the G&D Farms Outdoor Expo, day number two. And what a conversation with Dr. Bronson Strickland. He will be speaking today at 1 o'clock and 1 o'clock tomorrow. And when this man, because I know he knows the microphone, but those come with headsets. If he'll put them on his head, then we'll start talking to none other than my friend, Alabama and turkey hunting legend, Eddie Salter. Good to see you, sir. You good?
Can you hear me, man?
I can hear you. Can
all
you hear
right.
me?
Oh, I can't hear you good.
Yeah. I'll just yell. I'll yell low. Yeah, I wasn't talking. That's why you couldn't hear me. When
that's
I don't
right.
talk, you can't hear me.
There you go, bro.
Brother, good to see you.
Hey, man, it's great to be here. Be good to see you again. It's been a whole year. We got to do it more than once a year.
I agree. So before we get into all the other stuff, so how was your season?
Actually, overall, we're talking about turkey season from last year. I'm gonna say it was off a little bit.
Okay.
I mean, I think we got plenty. I think we ain't got plenty, but I think we got enough turkeys.
Okay. But what was off?
They just didn't gobble
okay.
good. You know, like I went out there, for example, during new season a day or two before, scouting some areas out, and then, you know, turkeys gobble every tree, seems like. And then you go back there, you know, 5 days later, and not even hear a turkey gobble. And, you know, it kind of seems like they'd gobble for a week or so, and then they just like they disappeared. They were zapped up, you know, satellite gun boomed them up. And then all you go back maybe a week later, then they all over. So, anyhow, I'm going to say it was off a little bit, but I think our turkeys have made a comeback. I think, you know.
In some places,
yeah.
right? So, you know, it's they are making some comeback, and we talk about it on the habitat side for brooding habitat and all those things that kind of used to just exist when people farmed. That
oh yeah, no doubt
you got to make it now.
Yeah, and I think too that I think if we look at it, the whole picture across the board, I think there's turkeys in areas that they hadn't been in several years. I mean, I think
right.
so they scattered out, but we got a lot of turkeys. You know where. At one time, you might have a 20,000-acre block. There wasn't no turkeys hardly in it. And then go, you know, down the road a little bit and get on another area, and they were loaded up with turkeys. Now
which
they kind of scattered out everywhere.
Back when they did that, though, we'd always say, why? Why are they over here and not over there?
I wish we could tell.
It's all in perception, too, of, like, having turkeys and not having turkeys. I think about that, and I had chance over the years to talk to Tom Kelly, and talks about his stories from the early days hunting here. I started hunting turkeys here. Hunted up a little bit in the 80s with my father and his friend, and it was getting a blind in a chufa patch.
Oh, yeah.
Wait and kill the turkey with a 20-gauge single shot.
Yeah.
Got out on my own, got to the University of Alabama, started hunting public land, and then got, you know, back then, I tell you, pressure-wise, I got in clubs for turkey rights. I didn't deer hunt.
They'd That's
say,
right.
Give us some money for seed, and you can have the turkey rights. You know,
yeah.
I mean, that was different days, but at that point, that's all I knew, and that's when the turkeys had come back so strong. That's all I That's what I knew. That was my reality. I didn't know the – I knew the stories of how tough it was in the old days, but I had never experienced them.
Yeah.
So for me, coming in really on my own turkey hunt in 1990, 91, I saw it – you know, I had this perception of how many goblin birds we used to have. So, yeah, it hit me maybe harder than somebody that started hunting earlier.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, no doubt.
You started hunting turkeys when?
Oh, I actually, you know, I started hunting turkeys for myself in the 60s.
Okay. So what was that like, your population-wise?
Probably in 1966, I think I killed my first turkey.
Okay.
And for me, it wasn't too bad because in right there, we had turkeys. Mm-hmm. I grew up on a 100-acre farm.
And y'all had them.
And we had turkeys and we had cows. And we would feed cows. We were, you know, the old-timey folks used to go out and feed them cows regular, like ear corn. Mm-hmm. You know, you buy corn. Mm-hmm. I mean, they would. Well, we'd raise it in the fields and just feed it to them. Well, that corn would just kind of run through them cows. Mm-hmm. And it ended up, too, it was a turkey magnet.
Yeah, I've killed a lot of turkeys in cow pastures.
And, you know, so they turkey's going to be where the food's at.
But to think about the numbers, like, then y'all had it on your farm right there, a place that had it. But you're now talking about their places that they used to not be. But we did see a reduction, I think, through the last 20 years of places where they were that they weren't anymore for a while.
And see, right around my home, more so back then, you know, I was talking about that the turkeys were maybe on 20,000 acres on, you know, or maybe 1,000 acres or what. But then you may have farms that wasn't just beautiful, wasn't any a turkey on. But then I got to going up to Wilcox County.
Mm-hmm.
I got introduced to some of that up there, and it was unreal. Yeah. I got introduced. I was hunting on, I don't know, roughly around 80,000 acres that I had permission that you could buy across the board. Yeah, I mean,
80,000.
You had Macmillan Blowdale.
Oh, you're talking about Timberland. Yeah.
And Wilmot Timber.
Yeah.
And you had International Paper Company.
Yep.
That you could buy permission.
Yeah,
you could
they
buy
had those.
Permit.
Yeah, yeah.
But what I'm saying is, I could go up there right around the little place in Wilcox County, right there, right above Monroe County and Wilcox, before you get to Camden. Mac Williams up in the area up there, that from Monday to Friday, I could hunt a big area, maybe 10,000 acre block there that I never would see a person in.
Now, what do you think? I mean, obviously, that's
changed. Oh, now it's all leased out now.
Yeah.
But what I was saying.
But, and all those turkeys are getting hunted.
But right then, I could go, you know, and get out and hear 10 turkeys gobble in one area and drive 3 miles down the road and hear 10 more.
Yeah,
gobble.
Another bunch of them. Right.
So it was no reason that a guy. If a guy learned to be a pretty good hunter, he could just about kill a turkey every morning he went up there.
Well, and I remember back in the 90s, for me, and so it's not 66, it's the 90s.
Well, now this, this would have been off. This was here in the early 80s.
So for me, it was 10 years later.
Yeah.
And I hunted a lot of public ground. And I'd see some turkey hunters, but not that many. And I was hunting public. I mean, you can probably picture some of the places. I went to school at University of Alabama, so the places I was nearby, and had great hunts.
Oh, yeah.
Great hunts. And I don't know, you know, we used to say, well, they hadn't been yelper whipped yet or this and that, but the birds gobble, and a lot of them, you know, a lot of those birds that gobble would come.
Yes, sir.
By the way, I don't know if we're up against, we're not against break yet, because I want to ask you this question. If I don't ask on what we talked about earlier, my friends are going to yelper whip me, because I got a theory. So I live amongst the turkeys I hunt. I live here in Mobile County.
Yeah.
And we talk about what you said. They'll be blowing the leaves off the trees.
Yeah.
And then you can call, like, I remember my nephew twice this year. I said, hey, they were doing it yesterday. It was out of control. Be here tomorrow morning. You know, we'll go hunt. Here, maybe one or two roost gobbles, and then nothing. I'm like, and because I hunted them so much and be on them every day, I don't know what it is, but what you're saying is spot on. They could be blowing it up, and you would think it would, like, the next day be like, if it's going down, it'd be like half of that.
That's right.
But it's not.
That's right.
So our theory, and though I'm sure my friends listening will want me to ask you, so my theory is it's just like everybody gets down to spring break on Friday night and they party too hard, and Saturday they lay up in the condo and watch videos. The idea that they did it so hard, they gobbled so hard, strutted so hard that day, the next day they just said, man, I won't take it.
Hey, that's a good answer right there. I think that's probably about as good an answer as you could probably come up with.
That's my party too hard theory.
I don't think you could look at nobody and ask them, and they could give you a correct answer because they don't know. I mean, I don't think nobody knows. You know, I don't think – and I think that's what really keeps us going back because we can't figure them out.
100%.
You know, you think we think we got pretty well got it figured out, and then we find out we don't know nothing.
Yeah, it's like – and to watch, like, Dr. Chamberlain's work, too, with the – they had the listening devices for gobbles they put in different places and charting it. And then they're overlaying the high pressure, low pressure, temperature, all these things that we think, you know, definitely I'm a high pressure guy, this and that. And I mean, y'all, I don't mean hunting pressure. I mean barometric pressure.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And then it comes out, and there's some track to that. And then there'll be a day on his research, it's like low pressure, and they blow the leaves off the trees.
Yeah.
Like the day they're not supposed to gobble, then they gobble.
That's right. Like I said, we can't figure them out, and I think that's what keeps us going right there. So, for me, I get asked that a bunch, but this year seems like we had more of them days that they didn't gobble than we did the days they did gobble. But
because people will say this too, and especially I'm so lucky to live where I do a lot of my turkey hunting, but I was in camps and public land for a long time. If I'm not there, if I go on that day that they just decide to be quiet because they're partied out, then I'm going to come back and say, they're gobbled out.
Yeah.
They're gobbled out. They're done. Even though I don't realize when I'm at work on Tuesday, you know, back when I couldn't hunt every day, that they're blowing it up. But I assume that one window, not even 24 hours, you know, from daylight to 10 o'clock, I didn't hear it. So they're gobbled out.
Yeah. Now, who knows it? And, you know, I think, too, right now that, honestly, I think it's due to habitat nesting areas that the nests get broke into by coons or different things. I think we got so many more critters out there that hogs, you know, messing up a nest. I think back when I was a young boy back in the late 60s or early 70s right there, you would go through an area that the gobblers with the hens real strong. And then all at once, all the hens would be on nest, and they wasn't getting broke up, and they wasn't getting messed up with. So that gobbler would go 2 or 3 days out there. Where y'all at, girls? And not here. And then he hears.
It's beautiful to be there on the day,
But he hears that little hen start calling. Man, I think mama's calling me back. Well, right now, I think my theory is a turkey don't go many days. He ain't got a hen right side of it. So why has he got a gobble?
He doesn't. I mean, all he's got to do is strut.
And then, you know, and especially if he's a bad, you know, in some areas I think we get into what we call a bad boy turkey. If he's one of them bad boy turkeys, and I mean, what to say, he hears another turkey gobble, he goes down there and knocks the feathers out of it. He don't want nothing nowhere around him gobbling.
We've seen those. They will leave hens to go whip a bud.
Oh, yeah. That's right. No doubt about it. And I think you know, we run into that a lot of times. And if he's got mama side of him, he ain't got a gobble.
Yeah, and that's the thing you're talking about with the nesting getting messed up and then going to re-nest, that they don't all go to nest at the same time.
That's right.
Right? It is. I mean, the way God's plan is that all the critters go to nest at the same time, so they do whatever they call, scientists call it, predator swamp, and they all lay eggs at one time, so they can't get them all.
That's right.
But now with some, they don't nest at once.
That's right. Well, they get broke up.
Yeah.
They get broke up, and they go back, and they go through that whole routine again.
Because you're asking, you're looking like, why is that your certain part of the season? Absolutely. And I'm like, why is that head not on nest?
That's right. But the good thing about it, most of the time, supposedly, the theory and this research, if that gobbler breeds that hen one time, she can get broke up 2 or 3 times and go back, and her eggs are still fertile.
Right.
And because he fertile, you know.
She holds on to it somehow through the.
That's good Lord looking out for it right there. But even though they'll go through that, they'll go through the routine again. Even if they are fertile, they'll still go through it again.
Coming back, more with the Turkey Man, Eddie Salter, right here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. We are live at the G&D Farms Outdoor Expo. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors, live from the G&D Farms Outdoor Expo. And talking to my buddy and the turkey man, Eddie Salter. You'll be able to talk with him when you show up today. Eddie is set up amongst where I think only maybe three of the tractors in that room I want to buy.
Yeah, it's not very many, but I would love to have them too right there. But I'm set up in the seminar room right there.
So what time?
I'm on at 2:00 today. We would like to invite you to come down. And hey, if you got a turkey call or if you want to look at some new calls, but if you got one that you would like for me to look at or sign or either look at it and see
and do
how
both
it sounds.
And tell me why it doesn't work, why it doesn't call
that's
in. Like
right.
You say, Eddie, I watch you on TV run this call. And they're losing their minds over it. I run this call and the woods go quiet. Can you help me with that?
That's right. Well, yes, sir. That's what we do down here. And we talk in turkey and,
it's so good being good company because I worry about turkeys year round. People laugh at me. Even though I'm fired up for deer season coming up, I'm like, they're like, Solomon, do you ever not think about turkeys? I said, pretty much. No, I always think about turkeys.
I got that labeled a turkey man, so you know it's going to be on my brain.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, good company. I'm with the grandfather of this, yeah.
That's
so
right.
So, you'll be here. People can come in, talk with you, and then listen to you during the seminar.
That's right.
Are you doing it tomorrow as well?
I am.
Okay.
Yes,
what time tomorrow?
I'm going to do it at 2:00 tomorrow,
both days.
Too.
Okay.
Both days. Around 2:00. We got the B-Man on here, and then I got several seminars.
Yeah, you got your Latham Beekeepers, I love those folks.
Yeah.
They're going to be out there as well. I want to tell you all this. Remember those after-school movies, if you're my age, in your 50s here, the after-school movies where the drug pusher would give the kids some drugs for free to get them hooked on it? Now, I love the Lathams. I love them. I love their honey. But they have a thing called creamed honey. Have you had the creamed honey yet?
I have not. I'm going to try some
Don't
of
do it. It's the after-school special because once you get on it, you're going to be addicted.
I got you.
This stuff, y'all, it's like I'm a big honey fan.
Yeah.
Love it. But they do. They whip it or something. It's so good that there's like you shouldn't have it because once you get on it, I lay in bed at night thinking about
that.
I had some samples yesterday and bought some jars. I said, well, I'm going to save those for Christmas gifts and stuff like that. About 11:30 last night, just to tell everybody the truth, I get up, walk out to my kitchen, and eat half the dang thing. It's that good.
No kidding. Well,
so when you get on,
so they got some samples over there.
And
you can buy it in a jar.
Yes.
And they recommend putting it on a biscuit, or you can just
That's what they like for normal people. Yeah. Put it on a biscuit or something like that. If you're abnormal like me, you just sneak out there with the spoon and have it. It is that good. It is like I really need to have it in a lockbox with a timer or something. But, y'all, that's how good this honey is. Y'all need to check it out.
I will, man. I'm glad you told me about it. But there's a lot of neat stuff in here at the show that you can look at. Getting ready to plant your food plots, you can come in here and, talk to these guys about the food plot.
That's what I was like yesterday talking to Lee about this, that having these folks here, they're real. I mean, they have all the information. Lee will tell you, I buy my seed and my cattle feed and stuff from Lee at G&D, but He can tell you a lot about the seed, but you go with these guys and sit down, and you can go, all right, this field's real sandy.
Yeah.
This field's got a lot of clay. This one doesn't get as much sun. You don't want this for that. Get this up.
That's right.
It's that specific where it used to be, we'd just get some, whatever the mix was.
Normally just go buy some wheat notes and plant that in and then be
the old sportsman's mix or whatever,
that's right.
And you didn't notice that. Some of the things in the mix never came up, but now they got stuff. They go, okay, what is your soil like?
Yeah.
What's the sun? And they get you the stuff that works.
And I tell you, I've learned, too, deer, we turkey folks on my brain, but I love that deer. But also, I've got into planting a lot of clovers, and deer love that clover and all that. But I found out that turkeys love to come in that clover and bug in them in the spring of the year.
And if you'll go in there and mow that,
and
so it starts that new growth again, you got more grasshopper load than
that's it.
And those clover will bend over with the grasshopper.
And I tell you, a lot of that,
I find a lot of clover in turkeys that I clean.
They'll just eat it, and I used to quail hunt a lot, and then in like February, a lot of that clover would just bud out real good. And them quail would eat them young leaves off that clover, and it just they whole
they'd be
chest
puffed up.
That's right, and turkeys too.
It's amazing what a quail, and I like to quail hunt as well. But it's amazing, and I like to hunt wild quail, which means I like to walk around the woods with a gun and follow a dog for hours on end and not do anything. But what quail will eat? I mean, they'll eat an acorn. And people are like, there's no way. I'm like, those jokers will eat an acorn.
Oh, they will.
I mean, they're not eating a swamp chestnut or anything, but small acorns.
Yeah,
they,
yeah. The water oak acorns.
Yeah, they'll eat them.
Yeah.
You pick up, you're like, what is it? This joker's been eating acorns.
That's
you're
right.
not supposed to be doing that.
And I've killed a ton of wood ducks. You just acorns would be following them out, you know, because a lot
shoot
of times
them,
we
spit them out.
You know, we shooting them a lot of times right there at the roost.
Yeah.
You know, right when they get ready.
You're watching your watch, aren't you, Eddie?
That's right,
okay.
Watching my watch.
Yeah.
And you know, but you know, the thing is, you can't shoot very many of them anyhow. You
right.
better be watching everything.
Yes.
And I learned, you know, what I done was finally just take about five shells in there, you know, and try to kill a couple.
Yep.
If I was lucky, I'd defy. And then come on to the house,
yep.
you know, and don't worry about carrying a bunch of shells out there, will you?
It's a great way to limit the,
you know,
the
but
shooting.
Back when me and you were shooting them, we wasn't even looking at our shells. We was using lead shells too.
I am old enough that I did start, yeah, and I have back in the 80s, I was there for the last, for duck hunting, the last 2 or 3 years of lead.
Yep.
And I got to tell you, I mean, they've done a lot with the new rounds and all that for
oh,
duck
they
hunting.
Have.
But a high brass number five, old lead high brass oh, number five. That baby was, I mean.
Hey, I actually, and I'm, you know, and of course now I don't even shoot ducks now. Would you know? I would love to, but you talking about a high brass? Get you a high brass 7.5, and when they come in there real mm-hmm. close, we ain't got a prayer.
Yeah, so it's funny you said because that was always our mix.
Yeah,
so we'd have high brass fives and
okay.
then 7.5.
I got you.
Depending on the shoot you were doing. You know, like morning shoot, we could talk about this for 2 hours. Morning shoot, where they're going to be decoying, not landing on your hat.
Yep.
We'd be shooting those fives.
Yep.
Roost shoot, 7.5.
Oh, yeah.
Nasty.
Yeah. Come in there
and
get them. Hey,
I mean, nasty. Just fold them up. I mean.
But, you know, they've done a good, these steel shot nowadays, they've done a great
a lot.
Job. And, actually, if you'll pay attention and, you know, it's no extent, I mean, no reason that you don't really, you know, get the choke that matches the shells,
right.
you know, out there. You know, used to, you would think it on that steel shot, you would, I mean, we so used to using lead, we wanted to tighten it up.
Yeah.
But that steel shot,
it, bounce it, everywhere you do
it
that.
Don't want, it don't like tightening up. So, and how y'all doing today?
You know, one thing we didn't even get a chance, we're going to run out of time, but the TSS revolution is something as well. Like,
you
talk about it in shells and things have changed. The, you know, TSS is, and gosh, we probably need to do this on a future show because I'm going to start an argument as always. For TSS, for a lot of people, it's like, hey, I can shoot a turkey at 70 yards. For me, TSS, I carry a 410.
Oh, yeah.
For me, it made me carry lighter guns because, you know what, a 12-gauge by the end of the day walking around feels like
oh,
a million
yeah.
pounds on your shoulders.
I'm shooting a 20-gauge, but hey,
I shoot a 20 as well.
Hey, you know, I do sell turkey calls, and
yeah.
turkeys are made designed to call up and get them in that 40-yard.
I
don't want to shoot them at 70.
I agree, but you notice when TSS happens, like, we all, like, turkey world split. And some people,
right.
you saw them, they're like, I can shoot one at this distance and this distance. And then there's a bunch of us that went, and I can still shoot them at 40 and carry a lighter gun.
That's right.
I don't have to carry big 12-gauge.
Absolutely. You know, I know we're short on time here, but, you know, the problem with TSS is guys can't judge distance. And
right.
you get out there at 70 yards, it may turn into 125 yards, and you think it's 70 yards.
If
or
you
so, and you're going to cripple
you're
up. Cripple
turkeys,
island.
Right, shooting them too far. If you've got to carry a rangefinder turkey hunting, you're not turkey hunting. There's my
That's
mean
it.
Opinion
That's
for the
it.
Day. Always great to see you. Check
hey
out
man, I wish we could have more time. And
we
got to get together more often. Thank
we'll
y'all
do it.
For listening.
And I'll see y'all when you come out here to the grounds for the G&D Outdoors Expo, day 2.